This is the Hidden Killers podcast with Tony Bruschi and continuing coverage of the case against Karen Reed.
Here we are, day four of the Karen Reed trial, a field trip today that we're going to walk you through and some interesting testimony. It was a shorter day in court, out by noon, even with the field trip in there. Then everyone went to Chuck E. Cheese, got their tokens, and went home happy. Little trinkets that will sit on the shelf for years, eventually be ripped up by a vacuum cleaner and choked on by a pet. Okay, that's not quite what happened, but they did go to the crime scene. No Chuck E. Cheese involved, though, thank goodness. If you ever wanted to see what a murder trial looks like when it steps out of the actual courtroom and steps into the real world, day four of Karen Reed is what it was all about. No witness box, no exhibits, no cross-examinations. Well, at least not while they were out. Just 12 jurors, a judge, two sets of attorneys, and the Canton neighborhood where everything allegedly went down. This wasn't about legal arguments. It was about geography, perspective, letting jurors see the scene for themselves. Remember, we saw this in the Alec Murdaugh trial. Well, it has been a little while now. I was going to say not that long ago, but a little while ago. It all centered around 34 Fairview Road, the home where Boston police officer John O'Keefe was found unconscious in the early morning hours of January 29th, 2022. That's the place prosecutors say Karen Reed backed into him with her black Lexus SUV, leaving him to die in a snowstorm. Reed's defensive team, meanwhile, argues the whole thing is a cover-up, that someone else inside the house that night was responsible, and that the case against her is built on flawed assumptions and manipulated evidence. But before any verdict is reached, jurors need to see the physical space where all of this actually unfolded. So, on day four of the trial, the morning of April 25th, the court arranged what's officially called a jury view. It's rare, it's brief, and it's tightly controlled. Judge Beverly Cannone made it very clear before the vans ever left the courthouse, jurors weren't there to investigate, measure, or make conclusions. No photos, no notes, no conversation, just look, feel, observe. And when it's time to deliberate, you're allowed to consider what you saw. That's it. Tight leash. They even had, like the collars you put on dogs, the ones with the invisible fence, they had them on the jurors. And if they left the area where the jurors were supposed to be, like, oh, hey, look at this. Sorry, stay off the lawn. No, okay, that didn't happen either. But, you know, anything's possible. The scene was staged carefully. Karen Reed's black Lexus SUV was parked in the driveway near the curb, positioned to reflect how it allegedly was the night of the incident. The passenger side rear taillight, central to the prosecution's case, was visibly broken, just like it had been in police photographs. The jury wasn't told what to think of that detail, but the message was hard to miss. There it was, the exact kind of SUV prosecutors say delivered the fatal blow. The jury spent about 15 minutes at the location. They walked the driveway. They looked at the lawn. They checked sight lines to the front door, the side steps, and the windows of the home. No one spoke to them about what conclusions to draw. But both legal teams were present, and each side made strategic use of the space. Prosecutors directed the jury's attention to the height of the Lexus's bumper relative to the slope of the yard. The implication was that it wouldn't take much for someone standing near the curb to be hit, especially if the vehicle was backing up, even slowly. They didn't say that outright, of course. They didn't need to. On the flip side, Reed's attorneys subtly encouraged jurors to pay attention to the distances from where the SUV was parked and how far it was to the front door spatially, how visible was the lawn from the windows? How far was the fire hydrant from the body's locations? And what kind of angles were even possible in terms of visibility from inside the house? The defense wasn't offering an alternate theory in that moment. They were laying the groundwork. Their angle seemed to be, this is a much more complex space than you've been led to believe. The jury's experience at the site didn't introduce any dramatic reenactments or expert commentary, but it did have character visits from Disney characters. Tigger came out at one point, hugged everybody, they all got a photo, and a new little Disney pin take home with them. Okay, that didn't happen either. This was all about observation. They saw where the body was allegedly found. They saw the dimensions of the driveway. They saw the space between the Lexus and the front of the house. They saw the house itself. They walked in silence, accompanied by the judge, prosecution, defense counsel, and of course, officers. That's it. Karen Reed herself was not present during the visit. That's standard under Massachusetts law. Defendants generally don't attend jury view unless they're granted special permission, which wasn't requested or granted here. So while her vehicle was there and her attorneys were there, Karen was not part of the spectacle. Still, her presence hung over everything. The Lexus sat parked, its broken taillight staring back like a silent witness. It was one of the only tangible things connecting her to the prosecution's timeline, an SUV with a missing chunk of red plastic, positioned in a driveway that's become the centerpiece of the entire case. And if you've been following the story up until now, you know how big of a detail that is, according to the Commonwealth. Shards from that taillight were found in the snow near O'Keefe's body. They say the injury patterns match the kind of damage that a taillight could have caused. They say she hit him, intentionally or recklessly, and left him to die. The defense, on the other hand, says the evidence doesn't line up, that O'Keefe's injuries don't match a car strike, that the taillight shards were discovered later under suspicious conditions, that the entire premise is just flawed. La 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 la, we don't want to hear anybody else's stories. Although it does kind of feel like both sides are like that. And that's why we have such a divide here. Where I keep saying reality, the truth, it's more in the middle. It's not all one this, it's not all one that. So when jurors walked the scene today, they weren't just looking at a driveway, they were looking at a crime scene, the position, where things were. The prosecution wants them to believe it was created by the woman on trial. And they were doing it with the defense in their ear, quietly reminding them this scene might not tell you the story you think it does. One of the most understated but important elements of today's walkthrough is how differently people process space when they're physically in it. Photographs, they flatten everything. Testimony gets filtered through memory and language. But when you're standing in a real place, things sometimes start to click, or sometimes they fall apart. The slope of the lawn, the angles from the windows, the proximity to the curb or the front step, it's all more complicated and more real when it's right in front of you. That's why both sides fought for this visit. The prosecution believes a physical setup strengthens their case. The defense believes it creates doubt. And both teams believe the jurors seeing the layout for themselves gives them a critical edge. But everybody sees things differently. The trip wrapped up quickly, no drama, no incidents, just 12 people getting a sense of place before heading back to the courtroom where the rest of the day was reserved for expert testimony. The legal battle picked up right where it had left off, but now the jury had something new in their mental toolkit, a lived-in spatial memory of 34 Fairview Road. Not a diagram, not a photo, a moment in the real world that they'll now carry with them into deliberation. And it's going to matter. It is going to matter. Because when the time comes for them to make sense of what happened that night, they won't be relying entirely on words. They'll remember where the Lexus sat, how far the curb was from the house, and whether that layout made the prosecution's story easier or harder to believe. What they saw can't be unseen. And next, we're about to hear what first responders saw and measured when they arrived at that same scene in the dead of winter. When the jurors returned from the scene at 34 Fairview Road and filed back into the courtroom, they carried with them the weight of what they'd just seen. That driveway, the lawn, the layout, it's all big parts of this case. Then we went, shift gears, back from observation to examination with more expert witnesses. First up was Paramedic Jason Becker, one of the first people to arrive on the scene in the early morning hours of January 29th of 2022. His job wasn't to make sense of narratives or determine motive. He was there to respond to a medical emergency, and that's exactly how he framed his testimony. Becker recalled arriving at Fairview Road and finding John O'Keefe lying face up in the snow, not buried, not hidden, exposed. He noted signs of trauma immediately, bruising around the eyes, a laceration of the arm. His skin was pale. His body was cold. It was the middle of winter, and O'Keefe had reportedly been out there for hours. Becker stated clearly that by the time they got there, O'Keefe was already in cardiac arrest. The medical team worked quickly, but it was clear they were behind the clock from the very start. There was one detail that struck many people, a detail that's become a cornerstone of the defense's case. Becker said that when he arrived, he did not see any tire tracks over the body. No clear evidence that a car had run over O'Keefe or rolled near him recently. Now, whether that means a vehicle wasn't involved is a separate question entirely, and no one asked Becker to speculate, but that visual, no tire tracks over the man who was allegedly hit by an SUV, was underscored again and again during cross-examination. But I don't know that anyone's arguing that he was run over. It was more that he was hit. But if you can throw that in there, into the jury's mind, that creates a little bit of doubt. A little bit of doubt for something that's not really being asked or accused, but doubt nonetheless. As Becker continued, the prosecution turns his focus to Karen Reed's behavior at the scene. He described her as frantic, emotional, repeatedly asking, "Is he dead? Is he dead?" She was crying, yelling, overwhelmed. He did not, however, recall her saying anything like, "I hit him," or admitting to any wrongdoing. That's important, though. Prosecutors have leaned heavily on statements made by Reed and the immediate aftermath, but Becker, unlike some earlier witnesses, didn't report hearing any self-incriminating remarks. Instead, what Becker delivered was the unfiltered perspective of a first responder walking into a scene like this. A scene of chaos, a man dying in the snow, a woman panicked and distraught. Family members and neighbors nearby, everyone, varying stages of disbelief. He didn't try to interpret it. He just told the jury what he saw and what he did, assessed the situation, attempted resuscitation, and ultimately transported O'Keefe to the hospital under emergency conditions. During the cross, the defense carefully circled back to the absence of tire marks. It wasn't presented as a gotcha moment, but the point was made. If the prosecution's theory is that Karen Reed backed into John O'Keefe with her Lexus, where's the physical evidence to actually prove that and support it? Snow is a powerful record of movement, tracks, impressions. They don't just disappear without something disturbing them. The defense didn't push the issue far, but they didn't have to. The lack of tire marks was left hanging there, like a blank space on an otherwise detailed page. Words that don't need to be on the page, because no one's really saying that she literally ran him over. It comes up in conjecture. But it's more so, bumped his head or he hit the light or something. Because if you're up there hitting the light, you're not down there getting run over. Becker's testimony didn't offer any smoking gun, no shocking new revelation, but what it did provide was context, medical, procedural, and immediate. It filled in another crucial piece of the timeline from discovery to transport, and for the jury, it was one more chance to hear from someone whose only job that morning was to try and save a life. Then came the next layer, science. The prosecution called their next witness Dr. Gary Fowler, a pathologist from Good Samaritan Hospital. His testimony shifted the focus from a scene of the crime to the lab results that followed it. Dr. Fowler wasn't at the house. He didn't treat John O'Keefe. His involvement came hours later, actually, when blood samples from Karen Reed were analyzed at the hospital. One number dominated his testimony, 0.093. That was the blood alcohol concentration found in Reed's system at 9:08 a.m. on the morning of January 29th. 9:08 a.m.
from the previous night.
But remember, Karen doesn't black out, so, you know, good memory there. Several hours after O'Keefe was found and after Reed was taken to the hospital for a psychological evaluation due to her distress. The legal limit in Massachusetts, by the way, is 0.08. So at the time her blood was drawn, Reed was still legally intoxicated. It would have been illegal for her to be on the road all those hours later. Can you imagine what it was at the actual time? They say like an hour a drink. I don't know how scientific or accurate that truly is. But you're talking 9:08 a.m. and you start drinking the night before? This is a woman who's claiming it was 4 drinks, 5 drinks, 6 drinks, 7 drinks. Add shots to those drinks, mix it up a little bit. You heard her thing. She goes on for a long time, trying to explain how much she had to drink in a way someone with an alcohol problem only could. Where it takes you 5 minutes to answer a simple question. How many drinks did you have? It's pretty straightforward. But as we saw in court just the other day, Karen seems to have problems with that question. A lot of problems with that question, truly. In fact, let's take a look at some of her testimony recently about having drinks and exactly what she said to different reporters. In fact, let's go. Right now, I believe we're going to see or listen to one of her testimonies. This is with Gretchen Voss of saying how much she had to drink that night. They were going to listen to another piece that was also rather compelling, to say the least, where she talks about her alcohol consumption the night of the death of John O'Keefe. Let's take a listen.
And is the level of intoxication pretty high here for everybody?
It's happy.
Yeah.
It's,
you had a lot to drink.
I wouldn't say, I have like a normal amount. Like a vodka tonic every 40 minutes.
Okay. And so are you feeling like buzzed? And I'm not judging, I'm just trying to get
a sense. Buzzed.
Yeah.
A little vodka tonic every 40 minutes. Okay. I can understand that. Gets you pretty drunk if you're going at that pace. Can't say I haven't done the same before, but I can also say, stick at that pace for a few hours and you're going to be pretty good.
Clip 9, please.
And then we got this clip. This is from the day before, actually, but it's very revealing since we're talking about alcohol.
The final count suffered. The final count of my alcohol intake's probably about 5 or 6 or 4. That they were pouring me at McCarthy's, which is where I consumed most of the alcohol, was the weakest vodka tonic. It tasted just like old soda water with lime. Not that I need it to be a martini, but it might have had a splash of vodka in it.
What's interesting to me about this is she's talking about this like they just got to a new bar with friends. Like, I was over there, they were pouring such weak drinks. Not that she's discussing this with a documentary crew that's documenting the accusations of her murdering her boyfriend, where alcohol played a major role in it. She's talking about it like it's just any other subject. Yeah, they're really weak. Let's do another shot right now, shall we? There's a level of cluelessness here to Karen. Karen, people are investigating you. And you've said 5 different things now on how much you had to drink. And in this documentary, you just took it to a whole new level. Because you're saying, oh, it's weak drinks. Well, guess what? Restaurants typically pour a shot. You're probably used to getting doubles or triples or pouring your own. And yeah, sometimes it feels kind of weak if you're used to a double or a triple or pouring your own with no shot glass. that will feel weak to you. It doesn't mean there's no alcohol there. It means you have a very high tolerance level. So what do you do to fix that high tolerance level? Well, she's got a solution to that as well.
So I said, John, this drink tastes like it has no vodka in it. He said, just get a shot and mix it yourself. So each drink was being counted as a double. So I would get a vodka tonic and then I would pour a shot into it. So that would come as two. Frankly, it just felt like a regular cocktail. It was just a really weak pour. So I asked for a shot.
Really weak pour?
For my taste, it just tasted like that's the normal strength of what a drink should be.
I don't... She's got that permanent, like, I'm smiley. This is, you know, just a weak pour. I mean, John's dead. I mean, obviously she didn't know that at that moment. She does now, and this is the Karen you get.
So I had maybe two or three that are being counted as four and six. And I don't know. I felt fine. I felt like I was buzzed. And then there was one drink, the last one that was given to me, which I would have counted as three, but they're counting as my sixth cocktail. The guys that we were with bought a round of shots, and they gave me one that I didn't drink, but I poured it in my drink. So that's now my fifth and sixth drinks, with the seventh, which is a shot that all the men did, and I poured it. So that one glass that I'm holding, that I go into the waterfall with, has three drinks in it, a vodka tonic and two shots. And which is why John said to me, you're not leaving that drink here, like you haven't touched it and just poured a bunch of vodka. He's like, just take it with you, which is something he always did. So then I go into Waterfall and I put that drink down and I socialize most of the time. So that would have been my fifth, sixth, and seventh drinks. Then John orders me a drink at the Waterfall that I don't drink, that he takes with him. And then there was a round of shots that Chris Howard bought that I did take. So that would have been the night. But I did not consume nine vodka martinis or take nine shots, depending on how you count it. And the last two drinks, I didn't touch.
But 10, please.
Tell me you have a drinking problem without telling me you have a drinking problem. But drinking problems do not necessarily make someone a murderer. Or a killer, or an accidental killer, either. When you get behind the wheel of your Lexus SUV, after having that many drinks, because even at her low end, it would still have been illegal. At her high end, it's like blackout. But I'm guessing Karen probably has quite the tolerance, considering this is, you know, what they do there, as she says. But she doesn't get blackout drunk, remember that. Her words, not mine. Impossible. Can't happen. Well, it can happen to anybody, Karen. And in your first accounts, it happened to you. You never remember being at the house to drop John off. But later you have, you know, the perfect recollection. Anyway, I digress. Fowler walked the jury through the testing procedure, how the sample was collected, how it was stored, and how the analysis was performed. He emphasized that hospital protocols were followed and that the equipment used was calibrated and accurate. This wasn't a backroom field test. It was a standardized toxicology screening done in a clinical setting. No controversy here. The prosecution used this to bolster their theory that Reed had been drinking heavily into the night before and into the early hours of the morning. Well, I don't think it's really a theory. She just talked about it right there. Impairing her judgment, possibly her memory, and certainly her ability to operate a vehicle safely. It's a brick in their wall. Not the whole wall, but an important one. The defense, for their part, didn't challenge the number. They didn't try to argue that the test was flawed or that the blood sample was mishandled. Instead, they focused on narrowing the scope. They asked whether this BAC level taken hours after the incident could definitively tell the jury what her level would have been earlier that night. Fowler answered honestly, He didn't perform any retrograde analysis to estimate Reed's BAC at the time of the alleged incident. He didn't need to. That wasn't his role, and he wasn't there. So while the jury got a clear look at that number, 0.093, at 9-something in the morning, the day after drinking, they weren't handed a neatly wrapped conclusion. What it meant and how much it mattered was left up to interpretation. Still, the fact that Karen Reed was over the legal limit at 9:08 a.m. can't be dismissed. It opens the door to questions about impaired thinking, delayed reactions, and memory gaps. You know, all things that could maybe make you back into your boyfriend accidentally and not remember it, or seemingly have fleeting memories of it, because he wasn't mortally wounded, remember? Karen, you already told us that. I don't know how you know that. Oh, you were talking about that in the morning. Oh, that doesn't appear you were, because you were specifically asked, you're talking about dropping him off that night, right? Yeah. Even though your attorney likes to play mix up the words and see who believes. In contrast to the emotional intensity of earlier days in court, family members were crying, text messages read aloud, and cross-examinations. Today felt a little clinical, almost quiet. Jurors listened closely, some taking notes as the experts spoke. This wasn't about dramatic moments. It was about evidence, chain of custody, medical charts, toxicology levels, the cold side of a very heated case. Maybe that's what today was really about. Dialing the temperature down. After 3 days of emotional spikes, the trial paused to lay down facts. What did the first paramedic see? What did the lab report say? Not what someone thinks happened, not who someone believes is guilty or innocent, just the what, the when, and the how. After Fowler stepped down, the judge gaveled the day to a close, invited everyone close for a big old shot. She poured for everybody. Karen went around with a bottle, too. Okay, that didn't happen. That's like, no. It was a short session by trial standards, wrapping up around lunchtime. The jury was dismissed for the weekend. No new motions were argued. No surprise witnesses, just a clean break after a tight day of testimony. But what the jury takes from today, the image of John O'Keefe's body in the snow, the absence of tire tracks, the number on that blood report, that will carry forward into everything else they're about to hear, because the next phase of the trial won't just be about what was seen or measured. It's going to dive deeper. Yeah, it's going to dive deeper into what was said, what was remembered, what might have been left out. There's a lot to come in the trial of Karen Reed. Give me your thoughts in the comment section on what you thought of today's events and the trial of Karen Reed. And we don't have to agree. That's fine. I just, like I always say, we like to have smart conversations here. So just going, you know, you're stupid, or free Karen Reed, or hashtag this, or if you speak in bumper sticker, don't bother. But if you want to actually have a conversation and argue points that are you can back up without just saying things, go for it. Because again, I see some things on both ends. I'm not all here. I'm not all there. I'm very much in the middle. I don't think you have to have Karen Reed viciously trying to kill John O'Keefe for this to possibly be second degree murder. I also don't know that you have enough evidence for this to be second degree murder. And I don't have to have John O'Keefe being beaten up in the house to believe that maybe she didn't do this. I think at the end of the day, I'm still very much in the camp of, I don't think we all know what happened. I don't think Karen actually knows what happens. It was a totally horrible accident at the end of the day with a person who doesn't want to be accountable and will go to any length, including denying even possibilities of what may have occurred. and a side where the police really can't be trusted very well. And they have a track record of showing us why. So who do you believe in a situation like this, you know? It's times like this where you just want to sit back and, you know, maybe have a glass of something. And that's why today's sponsor is here. KR Vodka. Where memory fails, confidence prevails. KR Vodka. If you're watching this on YouTube, obviously that's a fake ad there. And it's satire. But it was Karen Reed on camera doing an ad for a vodka brand. Which would honestly not surprise me by the end of this. I mean, there doesn't seem to be any real length where shame comes into play here. Like, maybe that's inappropriate to do. Maybe that's a little bit far. So, there's an idea for you, Karen. It's another way to, you know, maybe reward the people who have been giving you all of that money for your defense fund that you don't have to pay. Send them a bottle of your KR vodka. You probably would sell a lot of it, actually. So I'm serious. Not a bad idea. I think I should probably get some sort of commission out of that for giving you the idea. But, you know, I mean, look at this stuff. KR vodka. And it's got the great slogan, too. Where memory fails, confidence prevails. KR vodka. Hair blowing in the wind. It looks like a fun one. Jesus. We're kind of a different true crime show if you haven't figured that out by now. Again, let me know in the comments what you think. Press subscribe if you're listening to the podcast. And if you are watching us on YouTube, press subscribe there too. And please give me your thoughts in the comments. My name is Tony Bruschi. Thank you for watching. Thank you for listening. We will talk again real soon.
Want to stay on top of the latest true crime cases? Press subscribe now and never miss a breaking update from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.